It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll continue our series of candidate interviews ahead of next Tuesday's special primary election in Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Today, we'll hear from Democrat Tricia Zunker. First, President Trump was acquitted on two articles of impeachment in the U.S. Senate last week. The two articles, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, were decided on by members of the House of Representatives. Democrats have a majority there. In the impeachment process, the Senate acts as the jury and votes on the outcome. Republicans had a majority in the Senate. The House's decision to send those articles over, party line vote for the most part, same in the Senate to acquit the president. Our next guest points out that the role of parties in impeachment wasn't a factor when the founders established the process. In fact, the role of parties wasn't a factor in anything at that point. And he says the two-party system and impeachment are not two great tastes that taste great together. Jacob Levy is the Tomlinson Professor of Political Theory at McGill University. Jacob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's go back to when we started this country. The two-party system as we know it today didn't exist, right? And there was no real concept that we were going to end up there. Can you talk about that a little?
That's right. At the time of the American founding, the founders didn't believe that there would be, should be, or could be permanent parties in a functioning democratic republic. They really feared the growth of permanent factions that would compete for election. They had no good precedent for what they were doing. The United States was the largest democratic republic that had ever been created, and it governed a more pluralistic, more complicated society than had ever been attempted with democratic republican forms of government. So they didn't know what it was going to look like. But in the grip of old political ideas about unity and saying the way that the people can govern is if the people all stand together in their pursuit of the common good. In the grip of those kinds of theories, they thought the government will be stable just to the degree that it's unified in that way. That's not how it turned out. We grew a party system against their intentions, even against the intentions of the people who brought it into being. In the 1790s, the early Federalists and the early Democratic Republicans, the Hamilton-Adams Party and the Jefferson-Madison Party, each of them thought, we are only forming a party as an emergency response to the fact that those other people are creating a faction. So without meaning to, they put the institutions and the distinctions in place that we now actually know we need in order to govern a large democratic republic in a pluralistic, complicated setting.
Yeah, you had a Twitter thread recently that caught our eye here on impeachment and the two-party system. And we'll get to the impeachment part in just a minute. But you write, the two-party system sometimes gets a bad rap today. But you say, in effect, we kind of needed it to function as a fledgling republic. Why is that?
The idea of governing a democratic republic without parties requires voters who have not just virtue and public spiritedness, but so much information that they can correctly judge a whole range of policies, a whole range of positions, and a wide range of pieces of information about the character of the people that they're choosing to govern. There's simply too much information. What parties do is they create an ongoing organization, an institution that has an incentive to monitor and contain the people who are running for office, because they don't want to destroy the party's name, the party's reputation, by having one really disastrous senator, representative, governor, president. And they offer the voters a shorthand that the voters can manage and make sense of. You know roughly what you're getting if you vote for a Democrat or a Republican in a way that doesn't require you to learn tens of thousands of things about hundreds of candidates for positions and policies that are too complicated for you to wrap your head around. So parties give us an institution for accountability. They let us have an ongoing opposition party that can help illustrate and bring to light problems in the incumbent party. And they allow for accountability within the governing party, because if a governor or if a president is getting out of line, the party has a reason to generally hem them back in. What political science has learned over the last 200 years is that under conditions anything like what we encounter in the modern world, you can't have democratic government in a large society without parties.
We're talking to Jacob Levy from McGill University, looking at the two-party system and how it plays into impeachment in the United States. And Jacob, let's turn to the impeachment side of things now. The founders created this system of, again, that word, accountability for the president. They didn't want a king or a, you know, an elected king, I guess. So they had this idea, hey, Congress, the legislative branch, can impeach them. Would that have worked better without the two-party system? Did that make sense as the founders were looking forward?
It made sense in the vision they had of the separation of powers, which was that the key distinction wasn't going to be between one side and another in elections, but between the legislative branch and the executive. They thought the legislature as a whole would always have a kind of institutional reason to be keeping its eye on the executive. And so the legislature would be the appropriate body to be able to hold the executive in check. There was some sentiment in the Constitutional Convention for having Congress simply choose the president. It was thought that that violated the separation of powers too much, and you wanted a president who had some independent base of support in the electorate. But it was still taken for granted that Congress as a whole, acting together, would provide a check on lawlessness, on foreign interference, on corruption, on abuse of power in the executive, and that in the event of abuse of power, of course, Congress would be able to come together and exercise this power to hold the president in check. And that the Senate threshold, in particular, of two-thirds really does require that you can imagine a Congress acting with two-thirds majorities on big contested questions. That's not something that we can really make sense of in a partisan world.
Yeah, that gets to the heart of things, impeachment and the two-party system. Where do those not work well together, as you see it?
No president has ever been removed by impeachment, though Andrew Johnson, at a minimum, clearly should have been. And there's perfectly good reason to think that President Trump should have been. Until Mitt Romney, no senator had ever voted to remove a president of his own party at the end of an impeachment trial. There have been federal judges impeached, and the process is the same, but judges aren't partisan. Once we have parties, the impeachment process for presidents, however, looks very much like the opposition party seeking to limit a president just because he's their opponent, and the governing party, the majority party, the president's party, acting to defend him, no matter what. That's what we saw in the Johnson trial. It's what we saw in the Clinton trial. There's a kind of exception for what was probably going to happen with Richard Nixon. But not only was the American party system very weak at that point, but the Republican Party in Congress was very weak at that point. So the only time we came close to impeachment working to remove a president, you had Democratic majorities in both houses and a Republican Party that was really very disorganized and incapable of mustering very much of a defense. What we're going to see going forward, in light of the inability to impeach Trump, even in the face of very considerable evidence, in the face of ongoing investigations, even well before the Ukraine investigation, what we're going to see going forward is that the executive is now significantly unconstrained. As long as the president has the support of one-third of the Senate, as long as there are 34 senators of the president's own party, the president can get away with more or less anything under the current system.
We're talking to Jacob Levy, Tomlinson Professor of Political Theory at McGill University. He's with us to talk about impeachment and how it does, or in many cases does not, function under our two-party system here in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our guest says the impeachment process and our two-party system don't function well together. Do you agree? If so, what should change? Do we need a different way to limit the actions of the American president? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the U.S. two-party system and how impeachment does or maybe doesn't work within that political structure. Jacob Levy is with us from McGill University, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about impeachment, how it operates under the current two-party system? Do you think it is a process that ultimately holds presidents accountable? Should we rethink it, replace it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jacob, before we bring our callers on, is there another way to hold the executive branch presidents accountable short of impeachment? If not, do we need one?
We certainly do need one. The rule right now that says sitting presidents can't be indicted for crimes is not written into the Constitution. It's a Department of Justice opinion and holding. It currently has effective force of law, but that could be changed. That would provide at least some possible opening for more genuine accountability. Failing that, there needs to be a significant increase in congressional investigatory powers, including the ability to subpoena with much reduced capacity for the executive to refuse subpoenas for witnesses and for documents. But to the degree that we now have a system where the president can't be impeached, the president can't be indicted, and law enforcement officials aren't even really allowed to conduct investigations that would come close to the presidency, you've set up a system for presidential impunity. Other democratic systems, other constitutional democracies, if they have parliamentary systems, they can remove the executive by the parliamentary caucus of the party. That is to say, the equivalent of the Republicans in Congress would be able to take Trump out of power and put some new executive, some new prime minister in that system into power. In a presidential system under the American Constitution, there's no way to do that. So we need to have some capacity to get personal legal liability onto the table.
Let's bring on a call.
If impeachment can't be salvaged.
Let's bring a caller on now. Andrew is with us in Waukesha. Andrew, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My comment doesn't have to do with impeachment as a way to check the presidency, but rather the presidential debates that happen every 4 years. Now, you know, you made the claim that the party system allows for more nuance, better than the citizens can provide, and yet the Presidential Debate Commission limits the debate to just the two major parties, and in that sense, wholly simplifies the process of us being able to check the president by voting for the president that we feel expresses the most nuance and most detail.
Andrew, thanks for the call. I don't want to focus too closely on the debates, but is there something about the magic number two, Jacob, if our system worked such that there could be viable alternative parties, would that somehow help have more of a check on the executive branch?
It probably wouldn't. Presidentialism tends toward two-party systems. The United States has an unusually intense two-party system. Most other constitutional democracies have at least a few regional parties or at least a few other parties that are represented in the national legislature, but they don't significantly affect the balance of power between the executive and the legislature. Reforms that would affect the structure of the party system could change who it is who gets elected. But I would say regardless of what happens with who gets elected, so long as you have a system that structurally looks like the American system between a president and Congress, you're going to need restraints on the office of the presidency.
Thanks for the call, Andrew. We'll go now to Roger in Eagle River. Roger, hello.
I guess Andrew hit my subject pretty well in a way there. You know, every 4 years we got a chance to select a new president. And I guess my only thought is, you know, right now, unfortunately, the influence that lobbyists and that have on the Senate and the Congress, you know, I can't help but think that this whole happening here is just to distract the public from the fact that, you know, they're unwilling to do anything about, you know, healthcare reform. and just a distraction. And, you know, at least we, you know, with a president with power, we are going some direction. And if the people don't like the direction we're going, in 4 years, they got a chance to change that direction.
Roger, thanks for the call. So a strong president can break through some of the maybe gridlock, some of the political influence out there, and we do have recourse to remove from them from office after 4 years, Jacob.
The charge against President Trump in his recent impeachment was that he was soliciting foreign interference in the upcoming election. How can the use of the ballot box be a sure restraint on a president if the president has impunity to commit crimes against election law, to solicit foreign interference, to encourage foreign powers to hack the email accounts of his opponents, to commit vote fraud is the stage that we're increasingly getting close to. If the FEC is shut off from its ability to function because the president refuses to put people onto the FEC, if the president can't be impeached for committing crimes against election law, if the president can't be indicted for committing crimes against election law, then you don't have any recourse within the system to ensure that the elections will be conducted freely and fairly.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Jimmy now in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hello.
Hello. I would say that if Congress needs to go to work and enact laws that describe the impeachment process in more detail and maybe give the Supreme Court Chief Justice more of a judicatory role and get more detailed on what a high crime and misdemeanor is, and so that when it does happen, they can't, the senators in this case and the House or the Senate side can't just say, well, what, you know, we don't think it reached the high crime and misdemeanor threshold. You'd have more detail on what actually occurred, kind of like you do in criminal law.
Jimmy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jacob, Jimmy wants to get over some of the vagueness of impeachment, lay out some more black and white lines from Congress that presidents shouldn't cross.
That vagueness was there partly because abuse of power is going to cover lots of different possibilities. When the United States was founded, the fear of foreign interference was that powerful overseas countries would be using their force, their influence, to try to subvert the United States. No one would have known to lay out the fact pattern for the superpower United States leaning on a much weaker foreign government to invent or fabricate investigatory material against a domestic political opponent. High crimes and misdemeanors was not a statement of a criminal legal standard. And every constitutional law scholar, except for Alan Dershowitz, when he's acting in his capacity as President Trump's attorney, has agreed on this for a very long time. It's meant to cover a wide range of things, up to and including obstruction of investigations into the presidency. That is obstruction of justice, obstruction of Congress. Those have been charges in all of the presidential impeachments up until now. There's not really a vagueness problem. The vagueness is there because the range of offenses is so large. There's no way that you can compel the president's party in the Senate to reach convictions. There's no specification that could force them to act so contrary to their interests. The institutional design just isn't well set up for it.
Jimmy, thanks for that call. We're talking to Jacob Levy from McGill University, professor of political theory there, looking at impeachment and the two-party system and how he says they don't function. The impeachment in particular doesn't function to hold presidents accountable, to rein in their powers. Jacob, it seems like this would be a tough problem to solve because either party, if they get their president elected, seems to want that president to have a lot of power, so there's no built-in desire on any side necessarily to rein that in these days, it seems like. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say. In the aftermath of Watergate, there was significant legislation passed to restrain presidential powers on a range of dimensions. But as I mentioned, that was a time of a very weak Republican Party at the national level. So you had Democratic control of both houses of Congress, passing statutes that were going to limit particularly the kinds of abuses that Richard Nixon had just committed. What it would take now, at a time of near partisan parity, and this near partisan parity has been going on since about 1994, what it would take now would be such an overwhelming bipartisan consensus against the past actions of some particular president who had lost office, that it's very hard to see how it would happen.
Does that make you worried in our last minute and a half or so about presidential overreach in the future?
Yes, it does. I think that there have been vulnerabilities in the American constitutional system that the last 3 years have really highlighted. And the having those vulnerabilities exposed is useful in some ways. Now we know things that we didn't know. But what we know is the president can act in really sheer defiance of the other branches of government, and we don't have an institutional fix ready to hand for when he does so.
Jacob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jacob Levy, the Tomlinson Professor of Political Theory at McGill University. He was with us today to talk about why he says impeachment doesn't work as it's intended under a two-party political system. You can still share your thoughts. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas at WPR.org. Do you think impeachment is enough, or do we need different mechanisms, different systems to keep presidents accountable? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. By the way, join us tonight at 6 for a live national call-in special covering the next step in the 2020 election, New Hampshire's primary night. Host Brian Lehrer from WNYC and Laura Knoy from New Hampshire Public Radio and callers around the country will talk to us about how this night went and how we pick our presidents. That's coming up today at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Up next, we'll talk to a Democrat running in the 7th Congressional District special primary election. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Members of the Hmong community are speaking out against a Trump administration plan to deport certain Hmong residents. It would apply to those who are non-citizens and have committed crimes or have standing deportation orders against them. According to Asian American advocacy groups, about 4,500 people could be affected. The news surfaced a few days ago after a Minnesota congresswoman wrote a letter to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Representative Betty McCollum called the plan, quote, unconscionable and said that it's, quote, a direct attack on my constituents and their family members. According to U.S. Census data, there are about 300,000 Hmong people in the country, including roughly 49,000 in Wisconsin. Yi Lang Zhang is director of the Hmong American Center in Wausau. He also serves on the boards of the Village of Weston and Marathon County and was recently appointed to the League of Wisconsin Municipalities State Board. Yi, welcome to Central Time.
No problem. I appreciate this opportunity to be here.
Well, what is your reaction to the Trump administration's stated goal of deporting certain Hmong residents?
Well, you know, my reaction is that I was surprised. Well, I shouldn't say surprised, but I was surprised at how quickly it's coming. You know, obviously me being a huge advocate for the Hmong community and also working a lot with individuals of all background in the Hmong community here. You know, my biggest goal is to make sure that their voices are being represented or being heard as well, and their concerns are being heard. You know, especially in my variety of roles and capacity that I serve in, the Hmong community or members of the Hmong community here are individuals who are oftentimes do not voice their concerns or their opinion often, and me being blessed with the ability to speak on their behalf, you know, that's what I'm intending to do.
And given that, since this news broke, what are you hearing from members of the Hmong community that you work with?
You know, I know that although the from my understanding that the news the State Department's working with the Laotian government to deport individuals who has a green card or has committed some sort of felony back to the home country of Laos. You know, this has definitely set a fear effect, a ripple effect all across the Hmong community members here. You know, although despite the fact that many of the Hmong individuals has become United States citizens, there are still quite a significant amount of individuals that are still currently obviously still on their green card. Even young folks these days that are in their 30s, and you know, they are afraid. They're worried about being deported back to a country that they have known nothing about. But as a matter of fact, you know, many of the Hmong elders as well are saying, you know, let's hear from the State Department. Let's hear them voice their, you know, kind of explain to this, and hopefully they would clear up any misconception or any misinformation. And that's what they want to hear. They want to hear what exactly is happening. And right now they're hearing that they are at risk of being deported. I know that back when General Ng Pao, who was a very distinguished individual in the Hmong community, passed away in 2011, many Hmong individuals were terrified that the United States government was going to start deporting them back because their leader was no longer here to speak on their behalf. And I remember many young folks sending messages back to President Obama when he was doing a YouTube Q&A or town hall, and they were asking questions, will the Hmong people be deported back to Laos? And now that it's becoming a reality, and those individuals are terrified about what's happening. And I know when General Ng Pao passed away, there was multiple dozens of elders who said, now that General Ng Pao passed away, they're going to deport these individuals back to Laos. And this is something that scares them.
One possible story I've heard for people who might be deported could go like this. Someone who was brought over as a child, as a refugee, was maybe convicted of a crime in their teenage years, has been in the United States for another 10 years, 20 years after that, has a job, is settled down, rehabilitated from whatever the crime was. That might be the sort of person subject to deportation. Is that your understanding?
That is 100% correct. We as a community failed these individuals when they first moved here. They were, facing racism. Their families were, were working day and night trying to put food on the table, trying to pay for bills. And then these individuals, in order for them to, protect themselves, they participate in gangs or were involved with bad influence and may have committed felonies or crimes. And they've now served their time. They've moved on from there, and they've now become contributing members of this community. But because of the fact that they've been denied, the fact that they've committed some sort of felony, some of them has been denied, the ability to become apply for citizenship, or either make the process a lot more difficult. And because of this, it makes it a lot more difficult for these individuals to attain that citizenship. And those are the individuals that are at risk of being deported back.
What kind of life would someone in that situation be facing if these negotiations with the Nation of Laos go through and they're deported to that country?
Well, the most important portion is that these individuals in the Hmong community here, they have a strong emphasis on family, family and their clan system. If they were deported back, that they would know nothing. Many of these individuals know, some of them don't speak Hmong anymore either. So if they were deported to Laos, they would be starting over exactly like what their parents did when the parents came here, where they spoke no English, but in this case, they would be speaking barely any Hmong, no Laotian, and having to start a whole life over. But at the same time, they're being ripped apart from their families, their wife and kids, or their spouse, their family members, and being, in a sense here, being ripped away from the very life that they've known. And you might as well just sentence them to life in prison. This is just something that's remarkable that I'm surprised to see even happening.
We're talking to Yi Lang Zhang, director of the Hmong American Center in Wausau, about efforts by the State Department to deport probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 5,000 Hmong and Laotian residents currently of the United States to Laos. Yi, for people not familiar with the story of Hmong refugees' arrival in the United States, can you talk about the American involvement in Vietnam and what led many Hmong to settle here in the Midwest.
Sure, and I would gladly do so. You know, back in the early 1960s and 1970s here, the United States fought during the Vietnam War, but because of treaties and agreements that were made, the United States were not allowed to go into the Laos due to agreements. But the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which was a trail that was north of Vietnam, were able to transport resources down to south to do their to the Viet Congs or their armies. That trail went through the country of Laos, and in order for the United States to combat this, they contracted or in a sense recruited an army of individuals of ethnic minority. Majority of them were, you know, Laotians and Hmong individuals, some as young as 12 years old, who were then in a sense there fight on the behalf of the United States to defend United States principles, values, and to defend the United States agenda in Southeast Asia there. And they were tasked with three very important goals. One was to obviously disrupt transportation of supplies from along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Two was to protect radio communication towers. And three was saved American pilots that were shot down. There was a story I've worked with Hmong community members, and their statistics have shown that the statistics that were said by the Hmong Center of Minnesota, that it took approximately about 30 Hmong lives to save one Hmong pilot. And by the end of the war, it was estimated that about 25% of the entire Hmong men and boys population died fighting during the war, and that was not including the civilian casualties. That did not include the lives lost during the Hmong diaspora or the Hmong's journey from Laos to Thailand to escaping persecution. That at that time there was about 300,000 Hmong people that lived in Laos. That's about approximately the size population of the Hmong community in the United States here today. And those individuals died there, and they went to Laos. And to be very frank, the United States government tried to, in a sense here, hide that effort. That's why at one point that army was known as the Secret Army of Laos, and they were trying, in a sense, to hide it. But if it wasn't for the churches and these individuals in the United States here, in a sense, exposing it, the Hmong community would, and sponsoring the Hmong community or members of the Hmong community and bringing them to the United States here, that story would have never been known. And because of that, the Hmong people were able to come here, become a member of the community, and become contributing members of this community. The Hmong community in the last 45 years here has made more progress than has ever did in the last 200 years. And now they've become contributing members. They've contributed they've become just as Americanized as any other American.
Yi, what's your message for the Trump administration and the State Department as they continue to work on apparently negotiations with Laos to deport Hmong residents to there?
I think what I would say is that I want them to come out and clarify any misconception, if there's any. That's the first of all. And second, is obviously remember that these individuals, you know, they have family members here as well. And we need to look at trying to create into contributing members, not just shipping them off somewhere else and getting, and in a sense here, letting them be someone else's problem. In a sense here, we need to remember that these individuals are Americans, and they came here not because of their own free will, but because they had to in order to escape persecution or even death.
Yi, thanks for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yi Lang Zhang is director of the Hmong American Center in Wausau. We talked to him about the Trump administration's proposal to deport certain Hmong residents to Laos. The move would apply to non-citizens who have committed crimes or have deportation orders against them. Coming up, we'll talk to one of the candidates in the Democratic primary for an open congressional seat here in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, our candidate interviews continue with candidates in the special election for the 7th Congressional District. That district spans 20 counties in northern and central Wisconsin. Voters there will get to pick the candidate they want to advance in next Tuesday's special primary. Today, we'll hear from one of the Democrats on the ticket. Tricia Zunker is an Associate Justice of the Ho-Chunk Nation Supreme Court and President of the Wausau School Board. She's running as a Democrat in the primary. Tricia, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
We'll start us off, if you will, with your basic pitch to voters. Why should they pick you on Tuesday?
Well, I have a demonstrated record of public service. I think there's a lot of things that we need to address here in Wisconsin 7, and we need somebody who's ready to get to work on day one. And I am committed to working across the aisle to achieve bipartisan solutions that make life better here in Wisconsin 7. We need people that are going to do that. There's too much with the tax, too much gridlock, and we need to get to work. We need to address this farm crisis. We need to address health care. We need to make sure we're taking care of our environment, and we need to address campaign finance reform. We need to get the corporate money out of these elections.
You mentioned the farm crisis. There's been a lot of attention to the dairy field in particular here in Wisconsin. What would be some of your priorities in Congress when it comes to those issues?
Well, I am a granddaughter of a dairy farmer. My grandpa had a dairy farm in the town of Easton right here in central Wisconsin. And so when I see what's happening to our small and mid-sized farmers, it is personally heartbreaking to me. We need to ensure access to competitive markets for our small and mid-sized farmers. We need to eliminate predatory business practices that hurt our farmers. We need to have funding for mental health assistance for our farmers. We need to ensure broadband access for our farmers and actually for everybody in the 7th CD. And we need to support our small businesses, because when we support our small businesses, we support our farmers.
Now, what do you see as other economic challenges apart from farming? You mentioned small businesses there. What do you see in the 7th? And I know it's a big district. There might be a lot of variety there.
Well, we have a number of challenges here, economic challenges. We have some deserts as they go to childcare deserts. We have to consider our aging population and making sure that we have people that are going to be able to take care of our aging population. And to do any of these things, we need to value our workers. We need to value the childcare workers and our other caretakers.
We put out a call for questions on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Mary Ann, who wants to know if you'll protect people with pre-existing conditions in the healthcare system.
Absolutely. We need to address healthcare. Nobody should die because they can't get the treatment they need. Nobody should go bankrupt because they can't deal with a medical situation. So we need to ensure affordable, accessible healthcare. People with pre-existing conditions should be covered without penalty. We need to make sure that when we're talking about affordable, accessible health care, we're also including mental health care in that discussion. And we need to take on big pharma and drastically lower the cost of prescription drugs.
There's a wide variety of health care options offered by the Democratic candidates for president. Where do you see yourself falling on the spectrum? What approach would you advocate for in Congress?
Well, I'll tell you, Rob, I have put thousands upon thousands of miles on my car and just as many minutes on the phone talking to voters. And I am hearing that there are people that like their health care plans. I'm hearing from union folks that negotiated their health care plans. And so I support a robust public option for those that want it and those that need it. But I think that health care decisions are deeply personal, and people need to be empowered in making those decisions. So we can't impose something on people before they're ready. So I know there's a lot of discussion about Medicare for All with the presidential primary, but I don't think that everybody in the 7th CD is ready for that yet. So I support a robust public option. But we do need to get the cost of deductibles reduced. I mean, the private insurance is just – it's so high. It's exorbitant.
And you mentioned hoping to work for bipartisan solutions. This has been one of the more divisive issues between the two parties. Do you see improvements that can be made, even assuming nobody can get everything they want, that both parties could agree on?
Well, it's unfortunate that it has to be so divisive. I mean, if we don't have our health, what do we have? Well, I think that approach in working with each other is so critical. We need to ensure that we have respectful communication, listening, and going to the facts and data as a source of decision making. And that's something we can do regardless of what side of the aisle we're on.
Talking to Tricia Zunker, candidate for Congress. There's a primary in Wisconsin's 7th District, a special election. Let's turn to climate change now. We heard from Craig on Facebook who asks what actions you would take to help prepare us for and combat climate change.
Well, I think that we need to address this climate emergency with the urgency that it requires. We need to ensure that we have clean air, clean water, and protect our beautiful lands from corporate greed for generations to come.
So what kind of specific things do you think could be – what kind of specific policies could be passed in Congress?
Well, we need to really focus on sustainable, renewable energy. We need to move away from the fossil fuels and reduce our carbon footprint. And this is something that we can consider in all legislation. I mean, the environment impacts everything that we do. So, for instance, we talked about the farm crisis. Well, we could, in addition to the other things that I mentioned previously, we could include incentives for our small and mid-sized farmers for their use of sustainable, renewable energy. But we have to listen to the scientists. We have to listen to the experts. And we have to address this climate emergency. And that's just something that we need to do generally, I think, in decision-making. Too many times people are making decisions based on, I don't know, emotion or corporate interests that might be funneling money into their campaigns. I don't accept corporate PAC money. I believe that we need to be accountable to the voters and to the environment.
And we heard from Dave on Facebook, speaking of money in politics, who wants to know what kind of campaign finance reforms you would support in Congress.
Well, this is interesting. I'm a constitutional law professor, and I teach my students about Citizens United, and of course I allow them to draw their own conclusions. But we need to overturn Citizens United. We need to get the corporate money out of politics. So many of these problems that we're dealing with today, we can get to the basis of it, and it's industries that are buying seats in Congress. You know, we could move forward if we didn't have the fossil fuel industry buying seats in Congress, or big pharma buying seats in Congress, or big ag buying seats in Congress. And that's why I refuse to accept corporate PAC money, because we need to ensure that we have representatives who are accountable to the people.
There is the challenge of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling against some of the things Congress has done over the years. Given the reality of the Supreme Court as it exists now, do you think you could pass significant campaign finance legislation that would pass the court?
Well, we have to try. I mean, we have to at least get the right people in the seats to try. And I'm a hard worker. I'm dedicated. And it's important to me to be effective. And I see firsthand how critical campaign finance reform is in our elections. I am a solo parent, and I have to continue to work to support my household while also campaigning full-time plus in this 26-county district. And so I'm making phone calls, and I'm getting $10, $20 donations, and I appreciate each and every one of those. I know the value of a hard-earned dollar. But to see my opponents, whichever one it ends up being, having this money funneling into our state, it's frustrating. It keeps out people that would be effective representatives for the people.
We also heard from Peggy, who asks, would you support term limits for all politicians?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think we have to discuss what term limits we're talking about. And I see – I'm a member of Ho-Chunk Nation, and I see we have term limits in our legislature. And sometimes what happens is it might leave vacant a district that – is really well represented, and then somebody else isn't there to fill that seat. So I know that there's a lot of value in moving over, stepping aside, and letting other people now be a representative, but we have to also consider the detrimental impacts. The other thing that we have to consider, and especially with congressional terms, is they're only 2 years. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes work that has to happen as far as establishing relationships. You talk about working across the aisle. That's going to take some time. When I first got on the school board here in Wausau School Board, the very first thing I did was reach out to each and every board member and ask them if they would make time for coffee or a meeting so that I could have a one-on-one with every board member and establish a relationship. That was just eight other board members, and that took a little bit of time. So as far as term limits, I think in theory it sounds great, but you have to think practically how it could actually end up leaving a district not as well represented.
And finally, if you're elected, what is your day one priority in Congress?
Well, I think that we have to address healthcare, and I think specifically within healthcare, prescription drugs. Big pharma is getting away with something that's just terrible. I worked in intellectual property early in my legal career, and I sit here, I see big pharma charging us here in America 10 times what they are charging that exact same drug or medication in other countries, and it's wrong. And this isn't controversial. I don't think anybody's going to say, oh no, I want to keep paying these skyrocketing costs on my prescription drugs. I mean, we have seniors that are rationing their medication. That is not acceptable. So there is something that was sitting on Mitch McConnell's legislative graveyard, H.R. 3, that would have lowered the cost of 250 medications and drugs. And I think that this is something we can achieve. We can achieve this through bipartisan measures. And this is what I would be focused on.
Tricia, thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's Tricia Zunker. She's an Associate Justice of the Ho-Chunk Nation Supreme Court and President of the Wausau School Board and a Democratic candidate in the special primary race for the 7th Congressional District. To hear our conversation with one of the Republican candidates in that race, tune into Central Time Thursday at 3:30. Tune into the morning show tomorrow for another state Supreme Court primary interview. And catch up on all these interviews at WPR.org and click on the politics link in the news tab. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get more on the national political scene after the New Hampshire primary and sort out what, if anything, the results tell us about the race for the Democratic nomination. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. This was weird. If you saw a lot of people trying to balance brooms yesterday, you were not alone. A viral post claimed that NASA announced that yesterday was a special day because gravitational forces would line up to make it possible to make a broom stand up on its bristles. To be clear, NASA did not say that. They posted videos of people on non-yesterday days balancing brooms on the floor anyway. Well, Central Time producer Dean Kinetter, always a quester for truth. You tried this out?
I did. I got sucked into the appeal Broom of this
mania.
Story. Yeah, yeah. A family member let me know. They were freaking out. I saw it going around online, and I started thinking about polarity of the Earth, gravitational pull. It didn't quite seem legitimate to me.
Right. So, but you took a broom, your standard household broom?
That said, yeah. I did still take the broom.
Now, do you have one of these angled guys? Because I don't think you can balance that. There's like some that are kind of more straight and some that are kind of...
It wasn't a classic bristle broom, no. Uh-huh. It was the kind of the more modern, sleek, angled look that you're talking about. And I stood it up and it worked, of course. Still surprised me, though.
Now, did you try it today? The non-yesterday day.
First thing when I get home, that's what I'm going
to
do.
Okay, because NASA says, yeah, don't get sucked into this kind of thing. Just come to us. We'll make it clear that it doesn't happen. But it got you interested in gravity and cool stuff like that.
And reminded me about the importance of fact-checking, too.
Definitely.
Did that. And I got to say, it still looks strange. And I didn't know that it could necessarily happen. So I'm glad I tried it.
We've all learned a lot of valuable lessons. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.